Amen. All of my life, I have loved this story of Noah's Ark. And when you go into the Bible, into the book of Genesis, and you begin to read through some of the details, you begin to see some of the things that I think are really funny. And then you begin to read through the lines, between the lines. So, for instance, did you know that in the instructions in Genesis, there is no way to propel the ark? And Noah built this great big block of wood and no way to get it to go anywhere. There were no engines, there were no sails, there were no oars, nothing. It just floated. And with that, not only was there nothing to propel it, there was nothing to steer it. There was no rudder. And so it's just out and drifting. And to me, this is a great metaphor. It's a great way to image our world. I love to think of our world as an ark. This ark that is filled with all the diversity that is creation. And so sometimes I imagine myself, what if I had been able to volunteer and be on the crew of Noah's Ark? And you begin to think of some of the details. Wait a minute. No matter how big this darn boat was, how many animals did you try to cram into it? And then you had to feed them. How would you do that? And then if you really want to trigger your imagination, just inhale and ask yourself, what did that smell like? And if you're going to feed them, it means you're going to clean up after them. How did they do that? Well, again, it's the same when we look at our world and to say, here we are, all crammed into one boat. No matter what country you're from, no matter what language you speak, we're all on the same boat. And that boat doesn't know where it's going. It's just drifting, and we'll get there eventually. We're not sure where there is, but we'll get there. And in the meantime, you have to be really careful who you put next to each other. If Noah put the wrong animal next to the lions and the tigers, they would be eaten for lunch. And if they put the wrong animal next to the elephants, they might get squished. You got to be careful who you put next to each other, but we're all on the same journey, and we're all on the same boat together. Now, this is really, really powerful for me. Allison, if you would bring up the pie chart, I want to remind you of how diverse our world is. In our world, there is over 7 billion people, and that population is growing rapidly. These are figures from 2015, but 1 out of 3 people on the face of this planet are Christian. Now, of course, what that means is that 2 out of 3 are not. 1 out of 4 are Muslim. 1 out of 6 are Hindu. There's this tiny little slice, 0.2%, that are Jewish. And then there are all the others, you know, like Buddhism, at 6.9%. And what is amazing is to be able to say, you know, 100 years ago or more, if you wanted to meet somebody who was Hindu, you pretty much had to go to India. If you wanted to meet somebody who was Buddhist, you pretty much had to go to Southeast Asia. If you wanted to meet someone who was Muslim, you pretty much had to go to the Middle East. But not anymore. Every single one of these religions that we are looking at are found here within the Northern Hills. Very specifically, they are found here within Spearfish. And so what you will discover is that our students have classmates who are Buddhist and Muslim, And you may be a co-worker with someone who is Jewish or Hindu. When you are out and shopping, notice who are the people from different walks of life. You don't have to travel around the world anymore. It's right here, right now. Well, Jesus said to us, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. If it is true that we all live on this ark together, that is the world, that means that we have 7 billion neighbors. And if you're going to get to know and love your neighbor, you have to understand them. And that's my purpose. My purpose today is certainly not to convert you to Buddhism. My purpose is to reconvert all of us to Christianity and to understand more deeply what Jesus was saying when he said, love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. Now, I chose to start with Buddhism because this is one of those that I've had more direct contact with. I don't know if you knew this, but I have two daughters. And my older daughter is Grace. Grace is now back in the United States. For the last 4 years, she and her husband, Eamon, have been over in Thailand. And in the northern Thailand city of Khon Kaen, they have been elementary teachers. One of the reasons that they chose to go back was that they wanted to experience a foreign culture, and they specifically wanted to learn more about Buddhism. Thailand is powerfully, powerfully Buddhist, with about 80 to 90% of its population following various kinds of Buddhism. And exactly as in Christianity, there are all kinds of different versions, the same is true in Buddhism. There are different versions of the religion, of the faith, of the philosophy. Well, 2 years ago, we got to go visit them. Oh my goodness, did we have fun. It was so amazing being in this community where, of course, I stand about half a body taller than the neighbors, and my skin color just shines out. I kind of glow in the dark over there. And we were just so incredibly welcomed into their city, into their festivals, into their culture, and even into their temples. In a community that was pretty much 99% Buddhist, we got to go visit their temples. Now, in Thailand, they're called wats, and all of their wats are the same color. It's white, but trimmed with this gorgeous red and gold. And in the same way that in the United States, different churches have different shapes and sizes, the same is true there. Well, on one of the tall wats, we got to climb up and up and up, and from the top, you could just see across the city, temple, 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 temple. With every community, there was a temple, in the same way that in every community here in part of the community in Spearfish, we have churches. Temples all over the place, and we got to go in and to see these beautiful statues of Buddha and listen to the Buddhist chants. Now, one of the things that's very different about their faith is that in Christianity, we have a day of worship. In this church, if you want to worship, you come on Saturday night or Sunday morning. Well, in the Buddhist tradition, they don't have a day of corporate worship. The temple is simply open 7 days a week from early in the morning till late at night, and you come and go. And so these temples are incredibly busy as people are coming in for prayer, and they're coming in to talk to some of the Buddhist priests and some of the Buddhist monks. And these Buddhist monks in saffron robes are around. The young monks, the rookies, are in a yellow, and the older monks are in a deep red. And it was just amazing to be welcomed, to say, please, come in, explore, ask questions. This is what I'm inviting you into, is into a time and a place. Now, I do have to give you a warning. There's only one religion that I'm an expert in, and that's Christianity. And so when I'm sharing with you with this, you might want to write on your sermon notes at some point in here, yeah, well, Scott was wrong there. If you find out that I am misspeaking, if I get it wrong, please correct me, you know, in the future. And this is all part of the growing process together. Let me tell you more about who was the beginning and the origins of this religion. We simply know him as the Buddha. Now, you know that roly-poly, fat, smiling Buddha that we all think of? Yeah, that's not Buddha. That was one of the followers of Buddha. They call him a bodhisattva. But that is not the Buddha himself. Let me tell you about the Buddha. His name when he was born was Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha Gautama was born in the northeast part of what is today India, up in the area of Tibet, far, far north in the mountainous areas. His father was very rich, very powerful, and very influential. But when he was born, his mother died in childbirth. Oh my gosh, the pain, the suffering that was going on in that household. And it was at that point that Siddhartha Gautama's father vowed that he would not let his son be raised with suffering, and so he kept him protected in the palace. He was born in the year 563 BCE, 600 years before Jesus. And he was raised in power and wealth, in money and opulence and protection. Now, you and I would think that this was not even possible, but he was raised in that palace and he married in that palace. Together, those two had a son, but it was at the age of 29. Oh my goodness, how much of the world did you already see by the age of 29? He had seen none of it. At the age of 29, something happened that turned his world upside down. He went outside. He went on a ride with one of the chariot drivers of the palace and took him outside, and there, for the first time in his life, he saw someone who was old. His father had protected him from seeing the ravages of life that come to us with age. And he said to his driver, "What was that?" And his driver said, "Well, old, that's what happens when you get old." And Gautama said, "Does that happen to other people?" And the driver said, "Well, it eventually happens to all of us if we're lucky enough to stay alive." His father found out about this conversation, and his father said to the driver, "Don't do that anymore. If you go out, don't let him see those who are old." And so they didn't. The next time they went out, they saw no one who was old, but they saw someone who was sick. And Siddhartha said to his driver, "What was that?" And the driver said, "Well, that's what happens when our bodies betray us and we become ill. Does that happen to others?" "Oh yes, that happens to everybody." His father found out about that conversation and said to the driver, "Don't do that. If he goes out, don't let him see anybody who's sick." And they went out again. And they did not see anybody who was old, and they did not see anybody who was sick, but they did pass a funeral procession. Now, in his day and in that place, there were not coffins for the funeral. You put the body on a bier, which was then placed on shoulders and carried through town to the place where they cremated. Siddhartha Gautama had never seen a corpse. And he said to the driver, "What is that? Does that happen to others?" And the driver said, "It happens to all of us." This was the straw that broke the camel's back. And Siddhartha Gautama went back into the castle, and his entire world was absolutely flipped upside down. Everything that he had known was a lie. Not because it wasn't true, but because it had been in the absence of suffering. He had no idea what suffering was, and now he was hit in the face with the reality of suffering. What happened was that he left. He left the palace. He left his father. He left his wife. He left his son. He left his money. He left his clothes. He left his power. He left his influence. He walked away. The only thing that he had were the clothes that he was wearing and a begging bowl. And he lived away as an ascetic, a monk, you know, one, a hermit. except he was a hermit in the midst of people. For 6 years, until he was 35 years old, he lived as an ascetic, basically starving himself and understanding what was this suffering and how do we get away from suffering? How do we move past it and through it? Yeah, that roly-poly Buddha, that smiling Buddha that we know, no, 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 no. This was an incredibly unhappy man who was literally skin and bones. He looked a lot like this. Now, you'll notice that on this picture, there is a dot in his forehead because he was Hindu. Now, in the very same way that in Christianity, Protestantism broke away as a reform movement from the Roman Catholic movement, well, that's a great parallel. What Buddhism began as just one man who was breaking away in a reform movement from Hinduism. At the age of 35, after 6 years of starving himself and barely staying alive inside of that and understanding suffering in a very deep, very real way, he decided to do something different, and he went under a Bodhi tree. And for 49 days, he stayed under that tree in deep, intense meditation. It was on the 49th day that something happened, and I wish I had the expertise to tell you more deeply what that was. But in this deep meditation, there came a breaking point where he was able to let go of his attachment to the rest of the world. And he simply became enlightened. Awakened, he became the Buddha. The word Buddha literally means the enlightened one, the awakened one. And it was in that moment that he gained that independence, that breaking away, that letting go, that letting go of attachment. I'm not quite sure how to explain that, because it's a concept in Christianity that we have very few words for. From that moment, he began to live in a new way, and he began to eat, and he began to drink, and he began to enjoy life more, not in a physical way. He still did not own anything. He simply was a part of the world that was around him, a part of that creation process, and he began to teach others. He taught for the next 45 years. He did not die until he was 80 years old, and ironically, did not die a natural death. He died of food poisoning. He would have taught and lived even longer had it been but for that. So what then did he teach? Well, as he was moving in deeper into Hinduism and yet away from Hinduism at the same time, they developed some of the very basic foundation stones of Buddhism. And these included the Four Noble Truths. And it included the Eightfold Path. Now, in the same way that you and I have the Ten Commandments, and we have the teachings of Jesus, so the Buddhist and the Hindu traditions have deep, ancient words and techniques that they have been using. The Buddha died in the year 483 BCE, almost 5 centuries before Jesus. And you will find that there is a huge overlap in the quality of what was being said, of how to love your neighbor and not be in violence, how to focus on the things in life that really mattered inside of creation. I'd like you to watch a video with me that we give thanks to the Church of the Resurrection down in Kansas City for this. This is an interview that they had with one of the Buddhist ministers in Kansas City. Her name is Pete Potts. And you'll notice that this is somebody who could be our next door neighbor. This is not someone who looks, quote unquote, looks Buddhist. No, what does a Buddhist look like? Well, what does a Christian look like? We look like every race and every nationality. We speak every language. And so what you'll see is Pete Potts as she explains to us the Four Noble Path, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.
So the First Noble Truth is life inherently has some stress, or it's often interpreted as suffering. That's where Buddhism gets a bad name, as just being a big old downer. But it's the word dukkha, and dukkha is hard to translate, but it's stressfulness, it's not quite rightness, that's what it means. That's an inherent quality of life. And the second noble truth is that that dukkha, that stressfulness, that not quite rightness, is caused by clinging and craving, and the attachment to that clinging and craving. The third noble truth is that it is possible to relieve that suffering, relieve that not quite rightness. It's possible to stop that attachment. And the fourth noble truth is that there is an eightfold path. And if you practice and study and put into your life this eightfold path, that you will begin to see the effects of reducing your attachment and your craving, and therefore reducing your suffering. Those are the four noble truths. So the eightfold path, there's wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Do as much good as you can, refrain from doing evil, purify your mind. So that keeps it pretty simple.
Did you just hear what she said? I wonder if you would connect this. What she just said, the last things, were almost identical to our United Methodist three general rules. John Wesley said, part of our goal as Christians is to do no harm, to do good, and to stay in love with God. Very, very close to what Ms. Potts just spoke about. It's not that our religions are the same. They're not. It's that there are common truths that we hold, that there is overlap inside of how and what it is that we believe. Now, in Hinduism, this originating point of Buddhism, one of the things that the Hindus believe is that there is a creating God, a creating energy in this world, but that God is impersonal and out there. In comparison, what the Buddhists said was, no. That creating presence, that creating energy that some would call God is actually within us. It's not distant and impersonal. It is in us, and we are part of that creating process. It is an amazing thing to be able to say, this is who we are. Now, then what that would say is the Hindus would say in order to come to that point where you enter into, we would use the word heaven, they would use the word nirvana, that complete being with God, with creation, that you have to be reincarnated. There is a soul, you have a soul, but you don't go to heaven when you die, that you come back and back and back. The Buddha himself believed that he had lived over 500 lives. Very, very different from what you and I believe. You know, as we claim in our faith that when we die, we return into the arms of Jesus, into the presence of God, and they would say, nope, you turn around and you do it again. Until you come to the point where you are understanding and becoming one with creation. I'd like to have Ms. Potts explain more deeply about that with you.
When we talk about nirvana, the Vedic system teaches Atman, that there's a soul. And the Buddha taught there is no soul or self that comes in and lasts past death. That there is just this ongoing process of self that comes together and falls apart, comes together and falls apart. When that point is reached, it is as though you become completely and totally absorbed into the ultimate reality of things as they truly are. The you that you always were perhaps isn't knowable in the way that we've always known. But there is a you that returns and reunites, becomes one with, dissolves into. It's not a ceasing to exist as much as it is a existing everywhere all at once.
It is as though you are absorbed, become one with an ancient Hindu Buddhist story. There was a doll made of salt that lived in the desert and one day walked out of the desert and encountered the ocean. And she said to the ocean, "What are you?" And the ocean said, "Put your toe in." And the doll of salt put her toe in, and she understood immediately much more about what the ocean was. But when she pulled her foot out, her toe was gone, dissolved into the ocean. And she said to the ocean, "I understand more, but what are you?" And the ocean said, "Come stand in me." And so she went and stood up to her knees in the ocean, and she understood much more deeply what the ocean was. But she looked down and saw that she had lost her feet and the bottoms of her legs. And she said to the ocean, "What are you?" And the ocean said, "Come in." And so she went into the ocean. And there she dissolved and became part of it and understood what the ocean was. This is part of what this Buddhist focus is saying, that we are all together on the same ark. That's my Christian way of saying it. We're all together on the ark, and here we are to get along with each other because suffering is an absolute reality. But if we follow the Four Noble Truths and if we follow the Eightfold Path, then we will come into unity with each other and with this creating energy. You can see that there's so much that is an overlap between our two religions, even though the way that we process that and understand that is radically, radically different. And Paul said, "I believe that the suffering that we are going through now is nothing compared with the glory that we will know in God." And Paul said, "Rejoice, don't worry." This is what we do. We begin. To understand more deeply who we are and who others are as we look at our neighbors and begin to understand more deeply how we are different in order to understand how we can live together. May it be this week that you simply notice in the world around you as you are out and shopping, as you are out in our communities, notice who is it that is different from us, how and why. And as we are together, to begin to learn how